I want to move on to a subject, and we won't spend too long on this. A little bit, a word about copies. We've covered a little bit of this in our answers to questions. It's often assumed that since our earliest existing manuscripts are dated literally hundreds of years after the original autographs were written, there must be thousands of mistakes, right? You all know the argument. Copies of copies of copies, thousands of mistakes get in. Now, I can only answer that this impartial. I can't go into it in any depth, but let me check it out for you. Among the Dead Sea Scrolls discovered from 1947, Cave 1 contained a well-preserved copy of the entire prophecy of Isaiah. This was dated around 150 BC. I said 120, but about 120, 150 BC. That makes it, interestingly, 1,000 years older than our earliest copies up until then. The copies that we had of Isaiah were what we call the Masoretic text, and the earliest of them were written or copied out by the Masoretes in the year 800 BC or thereabouts. But what the Masoretes did, because Hebrew is a consonantal language, that means there are no vowels in it, no written vowels. It's written the opposite way to us. I can never remember which way we write. We go from left to right. Okay, Hebrew goes from right to left, and there are no spaces between words or sentences or paragraphs. You just run on, and there are no vowels, which makes it a very interesting language. And so the Masoretes put in what we call the vowel pointing. If you look at a page of Hebrew, lots of little dots and dashes and that, and they're the vowel pointing. They tell you how to pronounce the word. It's actually not as difficult as you think, because if you took all the vowels out of a bit of English, you could still read it, because you know where to put the vowels in. Anyway, they put it in for us. And in about the 8th century AD is our earliest copies of the Hebrew script. Now, when you've got a copy of Isaiah 150 BC, you've now shortened it by, I'm giving round terms, so don't pick me up on it, 1,000 years, right? Plenty of time for errors. This 1,000 years, in fact, more than that, 1,500 years from the time Isaiah was preaching. In fact, there is remarkable agreement between the Dead Sea Isaiah and the earliest copies of the Masoretic text, of the and the earliest copies of the Masoretic scrolls. Bear in mind, the Dead Sea community were not professional scribes; they were writing in their own dialect of Hebrew. So, most of the differences between the Isaiah Dead Sea Scroll and the Masoretic text of 800 AD are matters of pronouns, numbers, or spellings. Hezekiah the king, for example, has his name spelt four different ways. Well, don't bother about that. That's not a mistake. Listen, when Tyndale was translating the New Testament, he spelt the word it, I-T, eight different ways. Well, there's a job. If you've got nothing better to do while I'm talking, you can just find out how many ways you can spell the word it. In other words, spelling wasn't the issue. And I say this because the English Standard Version notes only seven places where they prefer the Dead Sea Scroll version over the Masoretic text. In the entire book of Isaiah, they said, well, there's only seven places, and they're not big issues. There's only seven places where they think they need to prefer one text to another. They don't significantly change anything. Now, if you go online and check me out on this, I know you'll find people who say this isn't true. There are hundreds, thousands of differences between the Dead Sea Scroll of Isaiah and the Masoretic text. That's right, but they're talking about pronouns and spelling and grammar. And that is not a mistake. That's just not a justifiable argument. We're talking about, is it the same text? And the answer is yes. Do a quick check if you want. If you've got an NIV, I haven't done this with the ESV, but I think it's the same. Check out at the bottom of the page of NIV through the book of Isaiah and look how many times they prefer what they call the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Qumran Scroll or the Essene Scroll. They use one of those words. They prefer that to the Masoretic text. I think in the NIV it amounts to less than 12 occasions in the huge book. Now, if they were that accurate from 150 BC to 800 AD, it is reasonable to say they were that accurate from 150 back to 700, which is when Isaiah was preaching. And we know that the scribes in the when they were copying the texts of the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures, they were remarkably careful. It wasn't sloppy work. Number one, they were professional scribes. Let's imagine this is a scriptorium. I'm chief rabbi. I like that. I'm the chief scribe. You're all the scribes, you see. And you're sitting there to copy out Isaiah. You are professional scribes. It's all you do every day. You don't do anything else. You're not going up to the office. You're scribes. You're here every day. It's all we do, copy out the scriptures. And when I've read out from my scroll, which is now getting a bit tatty, so we need to replace it, and you're going to replace it for me. When I read out the first line of text, you all write it out very carefully. And I will then tell you there should be, let's say, 25 letters in this line. You'll all count your letters in this line. But Gerard there, he's clumsy. So he doesn't get 25, he's got 24. He has got to start again because he's made a mistake. One scholar said everything that could be counted was counted. That's how careful they were. There were other things as well. They even told the scribes how to dress, what ink to use, and so on. They did it very, very carefully to make sure it was God's word. And they wouldn't change it either. And if a scribe working on his own ever came across a passage and he couldn't understand it, he would put a little marker in it that said Kethiv, which means it's read like this. And in the margin, only in the margin, he'd never alter the text. He might say, he would put Kere, which means, I think it should be read like this. And he would put what he thinks it should be. That's how careful they were. So just keep that in mind when people tell you about all these millions of mistakes that just get in because it's copied. And they always give you modern examples of that. Well, now, that's about how they were copied. Let's move on from that a moment. How early are our oldest copies of the New Testament? The earliest complete New Testament in one volume with all 27 books is dated around 300 years after the death of the apostles. Is that a long time? You may think so. Well, just check this for a moment. Josephus was a Jewish scholar who wrote his Jewish Antiquities, History of the Jews, around AD 93-94. So he was close to the time of the apostles, right? His work is used and quoted regularly as a valuable source for the history of the Jews from creation to the fall of Jerusalem. I have a copy on my shelf. I'm pretty sure the pastor has a copy as well. Tacitus, AD 55 to 120, was a Roman historian. Of his work, all that is now available are his annals, which covered the history of Augustus, the Emperor Augustus, to the Emperor Nero, and his history being the history of the Roman Empire from AD 69 to 97. Julius Caesar, you may have heard of, wrote his own account of his campaigns in Gaul, France. They are known as the Gallic Wars, AD 58 to 55 BC. The record is considered by all historians to be a valuable and authentic window into a crucial period in the career of Caesar and the development of the Roman Empire. So all three are, roughly speaking, contemporary with the New Testament. Let's compare the earliest complete copies of Josephus' Antiquities is 1,300 years after his death. The earliest complete text of Tacitus' Annals, 800 years after his death. And the earliest complete text of Caesar's Gallic Wars, 900 years after his death. Now, people don't tell you that when you pick up a copy of any of these three, and you can. They don't say, oh, by the way, hold on, before you read it, you do realize that this is absolutely packed full with mistakes and errors because they didn't occur until late on. These are all copies of copies of copies of copies. They don't tell you that. When I had to study Plato's Republic at college, nobody told me that actually what I was looking at were copies that were at the earliest about 1,500 years after the philosopher's death. They're the earliest copies we had. Nobody told me that. I just had to study it, and I was supposed to assume it was all correct. Remember, the earliest complete copy of the New Testament in one volume with all 27 books is dated around 300 years after the death of the apostles. So it compares well. By contrast to the less than a handful of the early texts for Caesar, Josephus, Tacitus, what do we have? What is available? Well, we have about 5,500 Greek texts, including full texts, collections, sections, and small fragments. So I'm not saying there are 5,500 Greek New Testaments. I'm saying there are 5,500 texts. The best known and the first complete is, and I referred to it earlier, Codex Sinaiticus. It's written in Greek capitals. It's the earliest complete copy of the New Testament in a bound book so far discovered, and it's dated around the middle of the 4th century AD. It was actually discovered in 1859 at a monastery on Mount Sinai, hence its name, and it originally contained the whole Old Testament plus six books of the Apocrypha, although parts had been destroyed with age. Sinaiticus was originally copied in Alexandria. It found its way to the monastery on Sinai, was discovered and sold to Alexander II, the Tsar of Russia, and in the communist era, they didn't want it, so it was purchased in 1933 from the communist authorities in the Soviet Union, jointly by the British government and the British Museum, for £100,000, and you can find it now in the British Library in Euston. But it's big, 14 inches by 16 inches. So, as we said earlier, you can appreciate why there were not too many of these around. To put the whole of the New Testament into one volume was a huge undertaking, and it demanded a very big book. But, much earlier than Sinaiticus, there are a number of smaller collections. Two things must be said about these. First, the dates are still being debated, but they are at least 100 years older than Sinaiticus. Second, the existence of a fragment means that the full text was almost certainly circulating at the same time. In other words, if you find a page in the street of the Gospel of John chapter 5, it's reasonable to assume that actually it came from the Gospel of John, and somewhere is the rest of the Gospel of John. Nobody wrote just a bit of the Gospel of John. Let me just give you a few examples, and I'm going to go from perhaps the biggest down to the smallest in three quick examples. The Chester Beatty Papyrus, known as P45, P46, dated around AD 200 and to 250. They contain between them 15 books of the New Testament. So well before the middle of the 3rd century, that's the 200s, collections were already circulating, because the Chester Beatty Papyri shows that. And then the John Ryland's Papyrus, which is known as P for Papyrus 52, it contains actually only 5 verses of John 18. But the interesting thing, it's from a codex, a book, and it's dated around 125 AD. 125. When did John die? Probably towards the end of the 1st century. Which means that within a few years of John's death, a copy of his gospel was already circulating in Egypt. To quote an earlier John Ryland's librarian, when the ink of the original autograph can hardly have been dry. In other words, within 25 or 30 years of John's death, his gospel was already circulating, of which the John Ryland's papyrus is part. Bruce Metzger has written one of the best books on the subject of New Testament canon, and he concludes that this little fragment, had it been known during the middle of the 19th century, the liberal critics from Germany, like Ferdinand and Bauer, he says, quote, could not have argued that the fourth gospel wasn't composed until the year 180. In other words, how could John's gospel have been composed in the middle of the second century, when early in the first century, 125 AD, we have part of his gospel. And then I'll tell you about the Qumran fragment, which is, I think, quite intriguing, and I'm not going to bother too much. Let's get up to it to speed. Qumran fragment, 7Q5, a fragment from Mark's gospel. These are the facts. In a cave by the Dead Sea, a number of fragments were discovered in 1955. All agree that the cave was sealed in the year AD 68 and it was not opened until 1955. No one disagrees with that. José O'Callaghan, a world-recognized expert in the field of identifying fragments of text, known as papyrology, identified one fragment as Mark 6, 52 to 53. Now, you're looking at that fragment and you say, well, that ain't much to go on. Well, let me tell you that papyrologists spend their whole life working on bits of text smaller than that. From that, they can find out where it originally came. And here's a little way you can check it out. If you took any magazine that you've got at home in your magazine rack and open it at random and tear out a 1-inch square from the middle of any page, you may have, let's say, a dozen or 15 words on that little 1-inch square, depending on the font size. You'll have a dozen or 15 words. You could run every computer model in the world and read every book or every magazine that there is, and there is only one magazine in the world that it will fit, and that's the one you tore it out of. Because the chances of coincidence of it actually fitting anything else are too remarkable to be possible, unless you're an evolutionist and then you can believe in anything. But the whole point is that they work on the basis that they can actually find where it comes from. Now, he claims to have identified Mark 6, 52 to 53. He actually claims to have found 9 other New Testament fragments for that same cave, AD 68, remember. The reason he did that, and the reason I circled the two letters there, is because those two letters are the two letters N in Greek. They may not look the same to you exactly, but I can assure you they are. Actually, nobody disagrees that they are double N. The problem is, what Greek words have a double N in the middle of them? And the answer is only the word Gennesaret. And you'll find that in that passage in Mark 6. And it's interesting that when you look at the other words above and below it, it fits perfectly that passage. Now, the problem is, as you can imagine, because this actually says, hang on, in a cave that was closed up in AD 68 and not opened till 1955, they have found a bit of Mark 6. That means Mark's gospel was written by AD 68. We can't have that, can we? So there is a lot of desire to destroy his conclusions. However, in 1994, one of the greatest papyrologists of our time, Orsina Montevecchi, then honorary president of the International Papyrologists Association, concluded, I do not think there can be any doubt about the identification of 7Q5. Interestingly, in 1946, the German liberal critic of the Bible, D.F. Strauss, suggested, quote, it would be an argument of decisive weight in favor of the credibility of the biblical history, which of course he didn't believe in, could it be indeed shown that it was written by eyewitnesses or even by persons nearly contemporaneous with the events narrated? Now, if O'Callaghan's conclusions are true, we now have that evidence. After the publication of O'Callaghan's work, Time magazine, no less, commented that we could now, I quote, make a bonfire of 70 tons of indigestible German scholarship. I think that's a very good idea. Now, that's a mere glance, that's all, because of time, of all that's available today for the text of our New Testament, from a complete New Testament to the smallest collection of books to mere fragments, and you're looking at a mere fragment on the screen. And I go back to, in a sense, where we started, and that is that we can believe in the providence of God, a God who ensured that his word came to us and was guarded and protected. And remember, because God chose to give us his word in the form he did, in the form of living letters. I'm thinking of the New Testament, but the Old Testament, of course, is very similar. The Bible comes to us in history. If you compare it, for example, with the Quran, there's not a word of history in the Quran. You can't check out the Quran. There's no way you can check it because it's just there. There's no history in it. The Bible exposes itself to be checked. It's full of history. It's written in a context. The letters of the New Testament are written by a real person to real churches in a real situation with real problems, asking real questions. And that's what makes it a living book and what I find so exciting about it when I have to study it and preach from it, because I'm not just quoting from wise words of some sage in a cave. I'm quoting from the living book that the living God has given us. And he chose to give it this way. And therefore he exposes it to the kind of criticisms that people bring and I've been looking at. But it holds together because it's a book that was written under the divine sovereign providence of God.